She was more than a rebel. She was a storm in bare feet. Queen Nanny of the Maroons led warriors through mist-drenched mountains, caught bullets with her hands, or so the British believed, and carved a sovereign nation from the jaws of slavery. No portrait survives, yet her face is everywhere. They tried to erase her. She became a myth. They tried to contain her. She became a spirit. This is not just the story of Jamaica's only national heroine. This is the story of a woman who turned memory into fire, and fire into freedom. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Nanny of the Maroons, A Journey Through Time, Episode 2. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 5, The Woman Who Could Catch Bullets. Some stories are too powerful to die. They move beyond memory. They transcend proof. They become something else, sacred. And in the hills of Jamaica, there was one such story passed from mouth to mouth, whispered into banana leaves, buried in the hearts of rebel children, and muttered beneath the breath of British soldiers who dared not believe it. That story was this: Nanny of the Maroons could catch bullets. Not dodge. Not deflect. Catch. They said she snatched musket balls from the air with her bare hands. Others swore she caught them between her thighs and spat them back as curses. Some claimed the bullets melted before they reached her. Some said they turned midair and flew back into the rifles that birthed them. And others dared to say nothing at all. Because in Nanny's presence, myth did not need explanation. It simply was. But to understand how such a legend grew, you must first understand what she was to her people and what she became to her enemies. The Maroon fighters who surrounded her did not merely follow her orders. They followed her aura. To them, she was not just a leader. She was a vessel for ancestral vengeance, a living shrine of defiance. In her presence, hardened warriors knelt without shame. Children watched her with eyes wide as stars. Women found strength in her silence. She moved like a shadow, spoke like a drumbeat, and stared like fire. When she entered a village, the wind shifted. When she touched the earth, birds went quiet. It was as if the land recognized her, as if the mountains themselves bent ever so slightly to make room. And she knew it, not from arrogance, from purpose. The first time the bullet legend began, it happened during a skirmish at dawn. A British patrol had ventured too far up the slope, trying to flush out a suspected Maroon lookout post. They came with confidence, muskets loaded, bayonets fixed, boots polished. They expected shadows and cowards. What they found was silence. And then Nanny. She stepped out of the brush without a weapon. No bow, no blade, just her body wrapped in cloth, her head tied in red, her hands open. The soldiers froze. One of them, young and afraid, fired. They all saw it. The flash. The smoke. The crack. And then nothing. The bullet didn't strike her. It didn't even pass her. It stopped. Midair. Hung there. Or maybe it landed softly into her palm. No one could say. But when she held up her hand, there was the ball, small, round, and harmless in her fingers. She dropped it to the ground like a stone. The soldiers ran. The forest devoured them. From that day forward, no British man climbed those slopes without remembering the woman who could command bullets to obey. But Nanny was no illusionist. She didn't seek to perform. The power she wielded was not for spectacle. It was psychological warfare, a fusion of spirit strategy and centuries of ancestral wisdom. She understood the greatest weapon of the oppressed was not just the blade, it was belief. If the enslaved believed they were cursed, they would crumble. If the soldiers believed Nanny could not die, they would break. So she nurtured the myth with the precision of a tactician and the reverence of a priestess. She wore charms, bundles of herbs, teeth, roots, ash, tied to her arms and ankles. She coated her weapons in concoctions that reeked of something unearthly. She bathed alone beneath moonlight in sacred pools known only to the oldest Maroon women. She would sit before fire pits for hours, unmoving, eyes closed, lips whispering words that made even her own warriors step back. they said her shadow moved differently than her body, that animals never fled from her footsteps, that lightning struck trees near her camp, never the same tree twice. Was it magic? Was it fear? Was it science misunderstood? No one asked. No one needed to. But to believe she was untouchable was to overlook her humanity. Because Nanny bled, there were nights when she retreated into the forest alone, to scream into the silence where no one could hear. She carried the weight of too many deaths, too many children buried, too many raids that failed. She had scars, some healed, others still red and raw. And the people she loved most were often the ones she lost first. One of her closest warriors, Kaiba, a young man she had rescued as a boy, was ambushed and dragged into a trap meant for her. His mutilated body was left at the foot of the trail leading to Nanny Town. She said nothing. She only wrapped his body in cloth and carried him with her hands, barefoot, back to the sacred burial ground. At his grave, she whispered one word, fire. That night, an entire plantation estate went up in smoke. No survivors. The British, unable to capture or kill her, turned instead to propaganda. They called her a witch, a demon. They printed pamphlets in Kingston warning soldiers of Nanny, the devil woman, urging them to shoot on sight. They offered bounties, hundreds of pounds of sterling, for her head. But none dared collect. Those who tried never returned. A few captured soldiers who had survived ambushes told tales that made the hairs on English necks stand straight. They spoke of maroons who fought without sound, of trails that changed shape in the night, of drums that echoed in the mine days after they stopped. But most of all, they spoke of her, always her, the woman who could not be killed. But what they did not understand, what they could not understand, was that the bullet myth wasn't just a tale of defiance. It was a story of resurrection. Every time Nanny was seen standing after battle, unbroken, untouched, the enslaved believed a little more. And belief, like fire, spreads. Men who had once trembled under whips now dreamed of the hills. Women who had once hidden their pain now sang Nanny's name in the fields. And children, born into bondage, grew up hearing bedtime stories not of princes or saints, but of a woman in the mountains who could catch bullets. And that was more powerful than any weapon the British could wield. There's one final story, whispered among the old Maroons to this day. A British captain, renowned Ruthless, sent to crush the Windward Maroons, assembled his troops for a dawn ambush. He had mapped the terrain, timed the winds, trained his men for months. As they approached the forest edge, he spotted her. There she stood, arms crossed, eyes calm. He raised his musket, fired. Smoke cleared. She was gone. Only a single red head wrap remained, tied to a branch. His men fled. The captain was never seen again. Whether she truly caught bullets is no longer the point, because in the hearts of those she freed, in the songs still sung across Jamaican hillsides, in the memories that have outlived every musket, every plantation, every tyrant, the story lives. And in those stories, Nanny still stands, unshaken, unburned, unbreakable. Chapter 6, The Battle of Nanny Town. War had always lived in the hills, but never like this. The sky above Nanny Town, once calm and clothed in mist, now boiled with smoke. The scent of war was everywhere, charred wood, sweat, gunpowder, blood. For years, the mountains had guarded the Maroons, shielding them with secret trails and fog-thick forests. But now, the British had arrived not in whispers, but in thunder. This wasn't a raid. This wasn't a search party. This was an army. The Battle of Nanny Town had begun, and at its center stood the woman they came to destroy. It started with betrayal. The British had long struggled to find Nanny Town. Their maps meant nothing in the twisting, rising terrain. Their horses slipped, their compasses lied, and their fear of spirits made even the bravest soldier hesitate in the woods. But eventually, they found a crack in the armor. A man, a runaway who had once lived among the Maroons. Angry, jealous, desperate. They promised him freedom, gold, even land, if he could guide them. He agreed. And with that, The enemy was given a path. Nanny sensed it days before they came. She stood alone at the edge of a cliff, looking down at the world below. The wind carried a different sound that morning, something rigid, something cold. The birds did not sing. The trees rustled without rhythm. The spirits were restless. She turned to her warriors and said, "The mountains are whispering of betrayal." Her eyes narrowed. "Prepare." Nanny Town was not a typical settlement. It was carved into the mountains like a secret. Narrow ridgelines connected huts woven from bamboo and leaves. Smoke from cooking fires was funneled underground so as not to be seen from afar. The forest floor was layered with soft ash to muffle footsteps. And just beyond the village perimeter were dozens of traps, deadfalls, spike pits, vine-triggered snares, and concealed pits filled with sharpened sticks. It was not a village. It was a fortress wearing the skin of nature. When the warning came, a soft hoot of the A-Bang echoing through the trees, Nanny's warriors were already waiting. They had trained for this. The British approached in long columns, their red coats like bloodstains against the green. They came with bayonets gleaming, rifles at the ready, cannons hauled by sweating slaves. Drums beat out the rhythm of the empire, loud and unrelenting. They laughed among themselves, certain this would be over by midday. They had numbers. They had maps. They had steel. But they did not have the land. And they did not have Nanny. The first ambush came before sunrise. A branch snapped, and then, hell. Maroon warriors, painted in ashen mud, emerged from the trees like phantoms. Arrows whistled through the air. Rocks rolled down from higher cliffs, crushing legs, cracking skulls. Smoke bombs made from tree sap and pepper exploded, choking the soldiers in clouds of red mist. Confused and stumbling, the British fell into traps. One soldier screamed as he disappeared into a pit, impaled on bamboo spikes. Another fired blindly, only to find his musket stolen from behind by a child who vanished back into the trees with a giggle. The forest had come alive. It was fighting for her. But still they advanced. Hours turned into a blood-stained morning. The British lost men with every step, but their numbers allowed them to push forward. They began to reach the outer perimeter of Nanny Town. They saw it for the first time. The huts, the fires, the flags made from feathers and bones, the symbols carved into the trees. And then they saw her. Nanny stood at the highest ridge, her red head wrap blowing in the wind, her hands raised toward the sky. Smoke curled around her like a second skin. The moment stilled. A British captain pointed. "Shoot her." They raised their rifles. But as the first shots cracked, fog rolled in. Not a normal fog. It moved with speed, with intention. It wrapped around the soldiers, blinding them, stealing sound. Horses reared. Men screamed. Their bullets flew into nothing. When the fog cleared, she was gone. Only her voice remained, echoing through the hills. "You fight with powder. We fight with blood. Let us see which is stronger." Then came the full assault. The British pushed into the heart of the village. Maroon warriors fell back not in retreat, but into positions. Higher ridges, hidden tunnels, camouflaged pits. Every corner of the village was a trap. Women threw boiling oil from hidden hollows in trees. Young boys hurled sharpened rocks. Elders stabbed from behind bamboo blinds. Every soul in Nanny Town fought. This was not just their home, it was their history. But the British had brought fire. They began to torch the huts. Flames danced along thatched rooftops. Smoke blackened the skies. Screams tore through the air, some from pain, some from fury. A child ran through the flames to pull her mother out. Her hair singed, her hands blistered. And Nanny was everywhere. She appeared on ridges, shouting orders. She tended the wounded, dipped her fingers into poultices, and chanted over the dying. She faced soldiers in hand-to-hand combat, slicing with machete, kicking, biting, hurling dirt into eyes. And all the while, the A-Bang blew, again, and again, and again. From every side of the mountain, new groups of Maroons began to arrive, not just from Nanny Town, but from other camps, other ridges, other valleys. the British were not fighting one village. They were fighting an entire nation. The tide turned by afternoon. British cannons, positioned too close to the ridges, were overturned by Maroons rolling boulders down from cliffs. Ammunition stockpiles, hidden beneath canopies, were lit ablaze. Smoke thickened the air so that no man could see beyond a few feet. One British commander fell to his knees, coughing blood, his voice hoarse. "They're not people, they're ghosts." His second in command took a poisoned dart to the throat before he could reply. Panic spread, and then retreat. The British blew horns, barked orders, pulled back. But the forest would not let them go so easily. As they fled, they were hunted. Silent shadows trailed them. More traps, more arrows, more screams. By the time they reached the lowlands, less than half remained. Nanny stood over the battlefield as the smoke cleared. Nanny Town was bruised, burned, bloodied. But it stood. Her people gathered around her. Some wept. Some collapsed. Others simply stared. She looked at the ground, soaked with blood, both British and Maroon, and spoke quietly. "This is the cost," she said. Then she raised her hands. "We will bury our dead. Then we will rebuild, again and again, until the day they understand we do not fall." The chant rose slowly, softly. "We do not fall. We do not fall. We do not fall." And the hills answered. The British, humiliated, called it a tactical failure. They blamed the terrain, blamed faulty maps, blamed weather. But the truth burned in their hearts and in their nightmares. They had faced something greater than an army. They had faced a people united by blood, spirit, and memory. They had faced a woman who would rather see the mountains burn than bow. And that woman was still alive. Chapter 7, Blood and Bamboo, War Tactics of the Maroons. The British had muskets. They had bayonets. They had cannons that belched fire and iron, horses bred for battle, and military tactics drilled into them from the moment they could walk. They had maps inked in London, bearing the illusion of control. They had banners and drums and uniforms so polished they gleamed like mirrors under the Jamaican sun. But Nanny's people had the forest, and the forest had them back. The Maroons did not fight like the British. They did not march in straight lines or announce themselves with brass. They did not die for medals. They fought for something deeper, for memory, for freedom, for those who had leapt from slave ships into the ocean and whispered through the tides to rise again. Under Nanny's command, the Blue Mountains were transformed into a living, breathing war machine. And the tactics they employed, deadly, elegant, ancestral, would become the stuff of legend. The land as weapon. First and foremost, Nanny taught her people to see the land not as a backdrop, but as an ally. Every tree, every slope, every leaf was part of the resistance. The terrain of the Blue Mountains was steep, tangled, and unforgiving, perfect for those who knew its secrets. Nanny's warriors could vanish into vines. They knew which leaves left no scent, which paths were quietest in rain, which roots gave strength when food was scarce. They used the altitude to their advantage. From high ridges, they could see the British moving in columns, far below, slow and exposed. From these vantage points, they planned. They waited. They struck. Even the soil became part of their defense. Trails were layered with fine ash that would reveal British footprints. Brittle twigs were placed strategically, so any step would crack like a gunshot. Waterways were booby-trapped with sharpened bamboo, stakes submerged in shallow streams. And caves hidden beneath moss and vines became hidden outposts, supply caches, and emergency shelters. The dance of silence. Maroon warriors learned to move without making a sound. From a young age, children were trained in the art of stillness. Games were invented to reward silence. Challenges required crossing long distances without snapping a single twig. Nighttime exercises were held where one had to slip past elders unseen, touch a tree, and return before being detected. These children grew into warriors who could stalk British soldiers within arm's reach without being noticed. Boots were forbidden during patrols. They moved barefoot or in softened sandals wrapped in cloth. Their footfalls were whispers. Their presence was smoke. By the time a British soldier realized he was not alone, it was already too late. Traps, blood, bamboo, and brilliance. The British learned quickly, often too late, that every tree could be a trap. One favored maroon tactic was the spike pitfall. Dug by hand, camouflaged with woven grass and soil, lined with poison bamboo spikes. Some were deep, some shallow, all deadly. Soldiers would be marching one moment and screaming the next, impaled and unable to be rescued without risking more lives. Then there were deadfall logs, large timber tied to tree limbs by vines and counterweights. When tripped, they would swing down with crushing force. Entire patrols were flattened before a single musket could be fired. But perhaps most terrifying was the whispering wall. This was Nanny's idea, an illusion more than a device. She had her warriors mimic human voices, calling out from multiple directions, speaking in English and African dialects. Soldiers would believe they were surrounded, firing blindly into the trees. In truth, they were being led in circles, toward traps, cliffs, or ambushes. The forest became a labyrinth of echoes. And then there were the bamboo daggers, crafted from stalks honed to razored points, dipped in a mixture of crushed scorpions, venomous plants, and swamp mold. A scratch from one could kill slowly, painfully. The Maroons left them hidden under moss, in doorways, embedded in trees. The British came to fear bamboo more than steel. Ambush and vanish. Maroon attacks were never prolonged. That was the British style, pitch battles, standoffs, sieges. Nanny taught her warriors to strike like lightning. A patrol might be crossing a ravine, tired and sweating. A rock would fall from above. Then another. Then two warriors would drop from the trees, just two, and slice through the line, striking the commander first. In the confusion, others would emerge from foliage. Arrows, machetes, slingshots. Chaos. Screaming. And then nothing. Silence again. The warriors gone. Only the wind remained. The British would waste hours pursuing shadows. They called them cowards. But deep down they knew the Maroons weren't fleeing. They were waiting. Misdirection and psychological terror. Nanny understood that fear was a seed. Planted correctly, it could grow faster than any tree. She encouraged her warriors to leave behind messages, not written ones, but symbolic. Blood smeared into ritual patterns. Figures hung in trees made of bones and feathers. British hats left on poles, split with machete slashes. A favorite tactic was to scatter black dolls with their faces painted white, each with a red thread tied around the neck. To the Maroons, it meant nothing. To the British, it meant they were marked. Sometimes she had captured British weapons returned to their original owners, disassembled, cleaned, and wrapped in banana leaves with fresh flowers. It made no sense to the soldiers, and that was the point. They began to question reality, to doubt each other, to suspect the jungle was cursed. Fear drained their energy faster than wounds. Children and intelligence. Contrary to what the Empire believed, the Maroon children were not liabilities. They were messengers, scouts, listeners. They ran between outposts faster than horses, barefoot and nimble, invisible in the trees. They delivered coded messages by song, by rhythm of drumbeat, by the number of birds released from a cage. One child, no older than 9, infiltrated a British camp by pretending to sell fruit. He counted the number of guns, noted the direction of supply wagons, and then disappeared into the trees. 2 nights later, that supply line was ambushed. No one knew how the Maroons knew, except Nanny. She trusted the young. She trained them herself. The role of women in combat. Nanny shattered every colonial expectation of gender. In British eyes, women were to be kept behind, cooking, cleaning, nursing. But in the Maroon ranks, women were archers, scouts, warriors, and spies. They led ambushes. They built traps. They sharpened blades. They were not support, they were essential. Many of the most feared Maroon warriors were women, silent, swift, and relentless. British soldiers later described being attacked by barefoot devils in skirts, who disappeared before they could reload. Nanny believed women were closer to the earth. that their blood, shed through childbirth and war, made them sacred. She gave them blessings before battle. She trained them in pressure points, stealth, and herb-laced poisons. She led from the front, always. Obeah and spiritual warfare. No tactic of the Maroons was more feared or misunderstood than their use of Obeah. To the British, it was witchcraft. To Nanny, it was balance, the weaponization of spirit. She used symbols carved into trees to ward off enemy advance. She placed stones in formations that summoned ancestral protection. Her chants before battle stirred the air itself. They say birds flew in circles above her head when she prayed, that the fog came when she sang. Some warriors wore charms blessed by her hands, ashes of burnt scrolls, teeth of wild dogs, feathers dipped in blood. These were not trinkets. They were armor. British soldiers described being paralyzed by unseen forces, of firing guns that misfired inexplicably, of dreams filled with Nanny's face, her eyes burning, her voice chanting in a language they didn't understand but couldn't forget. They began to believe she could not be killed, and that belief cost them everything, endurance and evolution. Nanny taught her people never to grow comfortable. Every village was built to be left behind. Every path had an exit. Every supply had a backup. They did not fight to protect structures. They fought to preserve each other. If a camp was compromised, it was burned and abandoned before dawn. They moved like smoke. They evolved with every attack. If a trap was discovered, it was improved. If a strategy failed, it was reworked. Nanny kept no books, no maps. Everything was taught orally. Knowledge was passed in rhythm, in riddle, in ritual. To the British, it looked like magic. To the Maroons, it was adaptation. By the end of the war, the British had spent tens of thousands of pounds, lost hundreds of men, and gained nothing but fear. The hills still belonged to the Maroons. The trees still whispered Nanny's name. And deep in the Blue Mountains, her warriors sharpened their blades again, not because they wanted to fight, but because they would never again be enslaved. Nanny had turned blood and bamboo into the tools of revolution. And the forest, once seen as wilderness, had become a nation without borders. Chapter 8, The Council of Shadows. There are battles that roar like thunder and light up the sky in fire. But there are other wars, quieter ones, that whisper through cracks in the stone, unseen, unheard, no less dangerous. In the depths of the Jamaican mountains, after countless victories and bloodshed, Queen Nanny faced a different kind of war. One without muskets or bayonets. A war of decisions, of doubt, of division. It was here in the shadows that Nanny's greatest leadership would be tested, not by the blade, but by the burden of holding a people together. The battlefields had changed, but the stakes had not. The British, after suffering humiliation after humiliation at the hands of the Maroons, were regrouping. Their strategy had shifted. Instead of brute force, they turned to espionage, bribery, psychological manipulation. They began to sow seeds of discord, offering treaties, gifts, promises of land, and peace. They whispered in the ears of select leaders, stoking old rivalries, creating cracks where none had existed before. It worked. And for the first time since the founding of Nanny Town, the Maroons were not unified. Cudjo, Nanny's brother, was a fierce warrior, brilliant in combat, and a born leader in his own right. He had led the Leeward Maroons in the Western Mountains, and his victories rivaled even Nanny's. But Cudjo was pragmatic, tired, wary of endless war. He had begun negotiations with the British. A treaty, recognition of Maroon lands in exchange for peace, and more controversially, for the return of escaped slaves. To Nanny, it was unthinkable. To many others, it was survival. The winds shifted. It was time to gather. They met deep in the forest, under a crescent moon, at the place known only to the oldest among them as the Root Circle, a grove where the trees curved inward like ribs around a beating heart. The ground was marked by ash and earth. Fires crackled low. The air hung heavy with smoke and prophecy. This was the Council of Shadows, a sacred meeting of Maroon leaders, strategists, priests, and elders. Some had walked through the mountains for 2 days to attend. Others came cloaked and silent, known only by the weapons they carried or the songs they sang in the dark. And at the center of them all sat Nanny. She did not raise her voice. She did not command attention. She was attention. Cudjo arrived late. When he stepped into the circle, he carried a British made sword on his hip. Nanny's eyes followed the blade, but said nothing. There was no greeting, only silence. And then the debates began. Voices rose. "We are tired," said one warrior, an elder whose limp bore witness to a dozen battles. "We bury our children in shallow graves. We fight and they keep coming. We win, but at what cost?" "They come because we fight," another replied. "If we stop, they will bury us all. They offer us land," a woman spat. "But the land is already ours." "What of the slaves?" one asked. "Will we hand them back to their chains? Will we become the hounds of the same masters we escaped?" More shouting, more pacing. Old wounds reopened. And still, Nanny did not speak. Not yet. When finally the voices quieted, she rose. Barefoot, cloaked in cloth faded by years of smoke and rain. She walked slowly around the circle, her fingers trailing the air behind her. When she spoke, it was not with fury, but with gravity. "They think we are divided," she said softly. "They think we will tear ourselves apart while they sit and sip their wine." She paused. "And maybe they are right." The wind rustled through the trees, as if holding its breath. "They offer treaties not out of kindness, but out of fear. And they promise peace, but demand betrayal. They ask us to hand back our kin, to hunt the very people who climbed these mountains barefoot with nothing but wounds and hunger and hope." Her voice tightened. "I did not build this place so we could become the gatekeepers of someone else's prison." She stepped closer to Cudjo. "You are my blood," she said. "But blood means nothing if it runs cold." Cudjo stared back, unmoved. "And what do we gain by dying in the dirt? They have more soldiers, more ships, more everything. You speak of hope. I speak of reality. You speak of surrender," she answered. "No," he said. "I speak of tomorrow." That night, the council burned hot with arguments. No decision was made. Nanny walked alone beneath the trees, the firelight painting her silhouette against the bark. She was not just wrestling with strategy. She was wrestling with grief. The grief of leadership. The grief of watching the people you love begin to doubt their own fire. In her heart, she knew war could not last forever. But she also knew this. Peace bought with betrayal is not peace at all. Over the weeks that followed, splinters began to show. Some warriors from the leeward factions left, following Cudjo. Others stayed with Nanny. But something deeper had changed. Trust had been shaken. The Maroons were still united by blood and purpose. But now shadows walked among them. Suspicion, hesitation, quiet disagreement. Nanny redoubled her efforts. She trained new warriors, fortified hidden camps, worked with herbalists to enhance stamina and clarity. She began preparing the younger generation to lead, to remember, to never forget who they were fighting for. And always, always, she reminded them, "The British do not fear our weapons. They fear our memory. They fear our stories. That is why they wish to erase us." But even as she worked, she watched. She watched as Cudjo's negotiations continued. She watched as rumors spread of Maroons returning slaves to the British, of deals struck in shadows. She watched her own warriors whisper about treaties. And she realized the battlefield had changed again. This war would not be won with arrows or ambushes alone. It would be won by protecting the soul of the resistance, the spirit that had lit the first fire, the legacy she carried in her blood. And so Nanny began her second rebellion, a rebellion of remembrance. She gathered the storytellers, the griots, the keepers of chant and drum. She had them record every battle in rhythm, every loss in melody. She made the elders teach the children the dances of mourning, the songs of Ashanti War, the rituals of cleansing. She made history alive, so that even if one day the treaties came and the guns fell silent, the truth would remain. She summoned the Council of Shadows one final time. This time, fewer came. She did not speak of treaties or weapons. She spoke of legacy. "Whatever you choose," she said, her voice trembling with a fire older than war, "do not forget who you are. They can take our land. They can take our bodies. But they cannot take our story unless we let them." She closed her eyes. "And I will never let them." Some called her stubborn. Some called her a prophet. But all agreed. Nanny stood for something that could not be negotiated. Something that could not be buried. Something that would never bow. And though the maroon world would shift, some choosing treaties, others choosing silence, Nanny's flame continued to burn. Not just in the mountains, but in every heart that still whispered her name. Because sometimes, the fiercest wars are not fought on battlefields. They are fought in the soul.